Hey guys, this episode of Deviate is a spoken word history of the grunge band I co-founded in Oregon in 1992. Right now you're listening to that band covering the song Love Buzz at the first concert we ever played. At the time I thought it was a Nirvana song, and it was from the 1989 Nirvana album Bleach, but it was actually Nirvana covering a Dutch band called Shocking Blue. We didn't know that at the time, but there's a lot we didn't know back then, as you'll soon find out. Our band was called Swizzlefish, and while not many people remember Swizzlefish, I spend the next hour making a case for why Swizzlefish explains the 1990s in a way that more famous bands like Nirvana or Soundgarden never could. Early on in this episode, I allude to a podcast called 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, which is hosted by music journalist Rob Harvilla. I actually interview Rob for 20 minutes at the end of this episode. Technically, that segment is an Easter egg, which means it should be a surprise, but in this case, I wanted to make sure you knew it was coming since it makes for an interesting Easter egg. Rob and I don't talk about Swizzlefish since I hadn't completed my hour-long spoken word history of the band when I interviewed him. So we talk about his book, which is also called 60 Songs That Explain the 90s. We talk about how grunge was thought to have killed hair metal and whether or not Kurt Cobain would have liked us as individuals back in the day. We talk about why Rob would have thought Rolf Potts was cool at the dawn of the grunge era, even though that probably wasn't true. We also go off on a tangent about my brief appearance in the 1992 horror movie Dr. Giggles. All right, here's the episode. One of my favorite podcasts in the past year has been Rob Harvilla's 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, which is produced by The Ringer. 60 Songs That Explain the 90s is just that. Each episode looks at one song from the 1990s and talks about its creation, its context, and its influences. Most episodes have a special guest who comes on to talk about the song in question. For Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit, it was Courtney Love, which is kind of awesome. But guests aside, I love this podcast because its host, Rob Harvilla, isn't afraid to talk about the songs in the context of his own life. Rob is from Ohio and still proudly lives in Ohio, and I respect any Midwesterner who's chosen to stay based in the Midwest because, of course, I am one of those people. I also love how Rob randomly paraphrases, say, George Orwell or the Bible or Kurt Vonnegut without telling us that's what he's doing. Listen to how he randomly works in the opening lines from Anna Karenina, A Tale of Two Cities, Moby Dick, and Catcher in the Rye in this setup about the opening lines from Vanilla Ice's Ice Ice Baby.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Call me Vanilla Ishmael.
All right, stop. Collaborate and listen.
If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you'll probably want to know is where Robert Van Winkle was born and what his lousy childhood was like. Now his parents were occupied and all before they had him, and all that David Copperfield kind of crap. But I don't feel like going into it, if you want to know the truth.
Actually, in playing that just now, it's weird to hear Rob Harvilla's voice like that, because I'm used to hearing him like this.
If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you'll probably want to know is where Robert Van Winkle was born, and what his lousy childhood was like. Now his parents were occupied and all before they had him, and all that David Copperfield kind of crap. But I don't feel like going into it, if you want to know the truth.
Yeah, I don't always listen to podcasts at double speed, but I discovered 60 Songs That Explain the 90s a couple years late, which means that I played catch-up by listening to the episodes at 2x. I've actually come to prefer listening to the episodes that way. To this day, I'm not really sure what Rob Harvilla sounds like on his podcast because I like his rapid-fire wittiness when you play him at twice the speed of his normal talking cadence. If I have a problem with 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, it would be that the podcast has been regularly adding new episodes for more than 3 years now, and during that time, Rob Harvilla hasn't once mentioned what I consider to be the song that best explains the 90s, and of course that song is this. That's the song Somebody's Liver by the Oregon grunge band Swizzlefish. It was the lead track on their 1993 album Big Time Loser. If that song doesn't quite ring a bell for you, well, congratulations, you're not alone in that regard. See, Swizzlefish was my band, or at least I was to Swizzlefish what Malcolm McLaren was to the Sex Pistols, if you get that reference. I also performed on some of their songs and wrote some of their lyrics. Now, 1990s music encompassed way more than grunge, of course. There are as many episodes of 60 Songs That Explain the 90s about Mariah Carey or CNC Music Factory as there are about Alice in Chains or Soundgarden. That makes total sense, but my experience of music in the early 1990s was largely, if not entirely, focused on grunge bands. So that's what I plan to explore in the context of my own grunge band in this episode of Deviate. The best documentary to retrospectively explore the grunge era was a 1996 film called Hype, which was directed by a guy named Doug Prey. I'm a fan of Hype for three reasons. The first is that I, which is to say Rolf Potts, the dude you're listening to right now, or at least a much younger version of him, can be seen in this documentary, kind of, for about a millisecond if you watch the outtakes and you know where to look. More on that later. Secondly, Hype offers the most succinct encapsulation of how the grunge sound diverged from the punk sound, which was this.
That's punk rock, and one day they just sort of started going, and that was grunge.
The guy playing those riffs was Leighton Beezer of the Throne Ups, a contemporary of Seattle scene bands like Mudhoney and Pearl Jam. Most people don't remember the Throne Ups, which brings up the third thing I like about the film, which is that it came out a few years after grunge peaked and thus wasn't tainted by too much hindsight. Lesser-known Pacific Northwest bands like Dead Moon and the Fastbacks are featured alongside Nirvana and Soundgarden, while Portland's Elliott Smith, who along with Kurt Cobain is now remembered as one of the great tragic Pacific Northwest singer-songwriters of the 1990s, isn't mentioned at all. This is in part because when Hype hit movie screens in 1996, Elliott Smith was only just starting his career as a solo artist, and also because his solo songs didn't sound like grunge, they sounded like this.
Send the poison rain down the drain to put bad thoughts in my head.
That's Elliott playing his song Miss Misery from the movie Good Will Hunting at the 1998 Oscars. Madonna introduced him, and Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On from Titanic ultimately beat him out for Best Original Song that year. But Elliott Smith didn't always sound like Elliott Smith. When I was going to shows in Portland in the early 1990s, he sounded like this. The song Low Life by Elliott Smith's Portland band Heat Miser, which sounded pretty grungy to my ear. I saw Heat Miser play live a half dozen times in the early 1990s, and on April 22, 1993, my own band Swizzlefish opened for Heat Miser. Actually, that's not true, but we did open for the band Dimbulb. Dimbulb later opened for Heat Miser, and well before Elliott Smith became famous, Heat Miser opened for the Portland band Sprinkler, who opened for Nirvana, which means that my band Swizzlefish was just 4 degrees of separation from the most iconic band in grunge history. You know what that means. It means nothing, actually, as you're about to find out. It also means everything in the sense that Swizzlefish, my obscure Oregon grunge band, explains the 90s in a way that no certifiably famous band can or ever could have done. You're about to find out about that too. Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today's episode is about the idea of alternate futures, or at least about the weird, mostly forgotten fixations of one's own youth. You know, back when I was getting my first bylines as a travel writer, I had this idea to write a book called How I Ruined the 1990s. Part of its conceit was that I would subvert the then well-established 20-year nostalgia cycle by releasing my 1990s memoir at the dawn of the 2000s instead of the 2020s. I'm glad that never happened, in part because in the early 2000s, I instead wrote a book called Vagabonding, which, to be honest, I was way more qualified to write. Still, I think about my never-written 1990s memoir sometimes, and maybe this episode is a way of exploring what it could have been. I will, over the course of this episode, illustrate how exactly it was that I ruined the 1990s, but I want to be clear about a few things up front. First off, while I was somewhat instrumental in the creation of Swizzlefish, it wasn't really my band. Swizzlefish was the creative synthesis of my college friend Steve, who was its lead singer, and my other college friend Ryan, who was the band's songwriter and guitarist. They were the Axl and Slash of Swizzlefish, as it were, the Jagger and Richards, the Plant and Page, the collaborative energy that made Swizzlefish Swizzlefish. Which I guess would make me a Brian Epstein to their Beatles, if you want to keep stretching the pre-grunge rock metaphors. The second thing I want to be clear about is that this is not a properly reported audio history of Swizzlefish. I didn't go out and collect audio interviews with Ryan or Steve or anyone else associated with the band because I'm less interested in the objective story of Swizzlefish than in the way it made me feel when I was a part of it and the way I've come to remember it now. This brings me to my third point of clarification, which is that I pay tribute to Swizzlefish not as a member of the band so much as a fan of the band. In a sense, I helped create Swizzlefish so I could feel a sense of ownership in the grunge zeitgeist of the early 1990s, and this episode more or less explores how that happened. Let's dig in. I moved to the Pacific Northwest from Kansas when I was 19 years old. The year was 1990. I often recall this time of my life in the context of my travel dreams. Sometimes I say that vagabonding was written with my 19-year-old self in mind, and that's true enough. But the moments in our lives can contain multitudes, and just as I dreamed of traveling the world at that age, I also dreamed of being a part of something cool. I realize that's a vague way of putting things, but I think a lot of what we feel when we're young can be categorized in vague terms. The music you're listening to right now is the theme song from the TV show Twin Peaks, which was set in a fictional town in the Pacific Northwest. When I watched that show in 1990, the fact that I was about to move to the Pacific Northwest made it feel like I was part of a nascent cultural moment. Little did I know at the time exactly what the world of pop culture had in store for the Pacific Northwest and Seattle in particular in the coming year. When we look back across the decades to examine certain moments in pop culture history, we tend to see things in terms of before and after turning point moments. For grunge, that moment came when MTV debuted this song, Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit, in September of 1991. As the story goes, this was the moment when corporate hairspray metal acts like Poison and Warrant began to lose cultural influence, and the pure punk-inflected sound coming out of Seattle began to dominate the airwaves. Indeed, by January of 1992, Nirvana's Nevermind album had replaced Michael Jackson's Dangerous as number one on the Billboard 200, and it felt like music would never be the same again. I was living just a few hours south of Seattle by then, and while I admit this all felt thrilling, it was never really that simple. For starters, what became known as Seattle's grunge sound had been around for years by the early 1990s, and while it proved popular on MTV, it didn't really dominate the charts. 1 week after Nirvana replaced Michael Jackson atop the Billboard 200, Nirvana was replaced by Garth Brooks, who went on to sell four times as many albums as Nirvana did that year. In addition to all this, moving to the Pacific Northwest at the moment the Pacific Northwest became cool didn't necessarily confer that coolness on me, in large part because I hadn't moved there to be a part of the zeitgeist. I'd moved there to run track and cross country for George Fox College, a conservative religious school in Oregon's Willamette Valley, a good 45 minutes by car from the city of Portland. I'd like to linger on this detail for a moment, since it's probably the most significant twist in this grunge-oriented chapter of my own life. Indeed, while Seattle was gaining a reputation for flannel-tinged mosh pits and heroin chic, I was attending college at a school where it was not permitted to watch R-rated movies or dance on campus, where getting caught drinking a wine cooler or having sex outside of marriage could technically get you kicked out of school. The fact that this place gave rise to Swizzlefish, a band that opened for 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 Nirvana, is maybe the most remarkable facet of this story. In a way, the ascendance of grunge in this prim religious setting is just as significant as whatever Nirvana's position was on the Billboard charts in the years that followed, and I intend to make a case for that in this episode as well. Now, of course, a lot happened during my years at college, including jumping freight trains across the state of Washington and planning my first vagabonding journey across North America, experiences I discussed back in episode 79 and 124 of this podcast. But for the purposes of today's episode, my most significant moment upon arrival at George Fox College came when I heard this song coming out of a freshman dorm room. Indeed, back in the days before social media and music streaming services, the best way to discern someone's musical taste was to hear what they were playing on their stereo. I literally met my friend Steve for the first time when I knocked on his dorm room door after hearing him play the song Ocean Size by my then favorite band Jane's Addiction. Steve was from a little working class logging town in Washington State's Mount St. Helens area, and when we were done talking, he lent me a dubbed cassette tape of a Washington band he said reminded him of Jane's Addiction. I listened to Steve's dub cassette almost every day that fall, and while I enjoyed the Jane's Addiction-sounding band on side A, I was blown away by the punk-sounding band that was dubbed onto side B. Ladies and gentlemen, I am not making this up. The album on side A was Mother Love Bone's Apple, and the album on side B was Nirvana's Bleach. At this point in my life, I was 1 month from turning 20 years old, and it was the first time I'd ever discovered something cool before everyone else in America did. To this day, I can say I became a fan of Nirvana when they were a mere indie band, a full year before Geffen dropped Nevermind. Did that make me cool? Kind of, by accident, I guess, in retrospect. But the best part of this moment wasn't that Steve shared the Nirvana and Mother Love Bone albums because he thought those bands were gonna get big. He shared them because those bands came from the state of Washington, and he came from Washington too. For him, it was local music. I may have stumbled onto what became known as the grunge aesthetic, but Steve was literally born into it, or at least he was born into the world that grunge pretended to belong to. Seattle-based record labels like Sub Pop may have promoted the music known as grunge as a blue-collar expression of the logging towns of the Pacific Northwest, but most of the musicians who played in grunge bands came from urban or suburban middle-class backgrounds. Chris Cornell of Soundgarden, for example, was the son of a pharmacist and an accountant. Stone Gossard of Pearl Jam was the son of a lawyer and a city government worker. This type of upbringing was the rule rather than the exception among the iconic grunge musicians of the 1990s. A key exception here was Nirvana frontman Kurt Cobain, who was raised in the Olympic Peninsula, Washington town of Aberdeen, the son of a waitress and an auto mechanic. Like Cobain, my friend Steve came from a rural Washington logging town where his parents ran the local convenience store. The thing is, guys from little Pacific Northwest logging towns didn't typically embrace punk rock like Kurt Cobain did. When I first met Steve, he enjoyed Mother Love Bone and Nirvana as regional hard rock bands, as well as heavy-sounding alternative bands like Jane's Addiction, but his core music obsession was more or less inseparable from hair metal. When I first met Steve, he confessed that he'd once written a fan letter to Guns N' Roses, and when he entered our school's student council-sponsored lip-sync competition his sophomore year, he brandished a chainsaw and pretended to sing this song. This is The Lumberjack by the hair metal band Jackal, and while I'm sure Steve, as a small town Washington kid, thought it was cool to lip sync to a song ostensibly about logging, Jackal would never ever be mistaken for a grunge band. Steve retained a slight weakness for hair metal throughout his tenure as the lead singer of our soon-to-be-formed grunge band Swizzlefish. One of my own key challenges as the band's manager was to dissuade him from scream-wailing his vocals or doing acrobatic high kicks on stage, both of which he was quite good at, in part because I was concerned that this kind of showmanship didn't accord with the punk rock ethos of grunge. I don't recall exactly when Steve and I decided to start our own grunge band at that little Oregon college campus, but from the outset, this task came with several problems, the most central of which was that neither of us played guitar or drums or bass, and neither of us had any experiences that qualified us to be the lead singer. Steve did play the trumpet, however, and it was while using a practice room at the campus music building that he heard the most amazing sound coming from a drum set next door. The virtuoso drummer in question was Ryan, a moody and melancholy freshman from Idaho. In addition to loving bands like Jane's Addiction and Soundgarden, Ryan sometimes drove into Portland to see indie rock shows at an all-ages venue called the X-Ray Cafe. I'll get back to the X-Ray Cafe in a moment since it became a part of our own musical story, but for now I'll simply point out that meeting Ryan presented us with both an opportunity and a challenge. The opportunity was clear. In addition to being an excellent drummer, Ryan was also a terrific songwriter and a decent singer, and he could also play the guitar and the bass. The challenge was that Ryan didn't really want to start a band with us, in part because we had almost nothing to offer him as bandmates. In the purely musical sense, Ryan's most logical option for starting a band would have been to recruit competent musicians and teach them to play bass and guitar lines for the songs he wrote. But Ryan was never that ambitious. Ryan was lonely and depressed, and he didn't really relate to anyone at our little religious college campus. Ryan didn't want to start a band. He wanted to drop out of school and go live someplace else. But that never happened, in part because Steve and I started following Ryan to Portland's indie rock clubs every weekend. Gradually, through the simple act of shared experiences in places like the X-Ray Cafe, Steve and I were able to convince Ryan to start his own band and to make us a part of it. Portland's X-Ray Cafe was, in many senses, an antipode to our safe and sleepy little exurban Oregon Christian College campus. Located on a gritty stretch of downtown Portland's Burnside Avenue, this grungy little all-ages venue hosted not just punk rock, it hosted lip-sync drag shows and experimental performance art and belly dancing and ukulele acts. Its walls were hung with black velvet paintings, and it had a stand in the back that sold burritos, which were actually quite tasty. The co-owner of the X-Ray Cafe was a guy named Trace Shannon, who later went on to start Voodoo Donuts, which was celebrated by the likes of Anthony Bourdain and now has branches in 7 states. By comparison, the X-Ray Cafe only lasted about 4 years, but during this time it was the heart of Portland's all-ages underground art scene, as the rise of grunge brought the music of the Pacific Northwest to international prominence. The first time Steve and I accompanied Ryan to the X-Ray Cafe was to see a 3-show bill. The opening band was Heat Miser, which featured a then unknown Elliott Smith. The headliner was Sprinkler, which had just released an album on Sub Pop, the Seattle indie label that had debuted the first Nirvana album a few years earlier. Sandwiched in the middle was Drunk at Abby's, a Portland band that became one of our favorite local acts, though Drunk at Abby's never went on to become famous. This is their song, Princess in a Cobweb. Within a week of that show, Steve and I had more or less bullied Ryan into starting a grunge band of our own. Ryan bought an electric pickup for his acoustic guitar and offered up his dorm room for practices. Steve decided that he would be the band's singer and part-time trumpet player. I couldn't play the bass or the drums. We had to recruit other people for those roles later. So it was decided that I would write occasional lyrics and sing occasional vocals and serve as the band's manager. My first task as the band's manager was to come up with a name, and anyone who's ever done this knows that it can be a delightful process. Before long, we'd assembled dozens of possibilities. Death Waffle, Wicked Pancreas, Abracadaver, 6-Pound Nipple, Handsome Wino, Swine Jam, Elvis in Chains, Baby Shit Yellow, Sin Celery, The Molotov Cocktail Waitresses, Escape Goat. Eventually, we narrowed it down to 2 finalists, Swizzlefish and Somebody's Liver. Swizzlefish, of course, became the name of our band, and amazingly enough, Ryan built one of our most popular songs around the phrase Somebody's Liver.
I'm the sliver.
Eventually, we found a freshman named Matt to be our drummer, and Ryan continued to write grungy songs with angsty lyrics. Somebody's Liver was a straightforward, grunge-flavored anthem that railed against the trappings of conformity, while other songs obsessively plumbed the various aspects of Ryan's own struggle with depression. Steve proved himself to be a decent, if not exactly virtuoso, vocalist, though at times his hair metal instincts, combined with his irrepressible exuberance at the task of fronting a rock band, could feel at odds with the emotional bleakness of Ryan's lyrics. Take, for example, this song. When Ryan wrote lyrics like Life is Pain or I Just Wanted to Die, he really meant it. Whereas try as Steve might to channel Ryan's angst when he sang these vocals, the literal despondency of the lyrics carried a slightly different energy when Steve sang them. Ryan was writing about the difficult task of being alive, whereas most of the time it felt like Steve was happy just to be singing anything as part of a cool rock band. as one fan of the band later remarked after seeing Swizzlefish live, quote, "There is something truly sublime about watching Steve sing Life is Pain over and over again while clearly having the time of his life," end quote. To this day, I think the creative energy of Swizzlefish existed in the tortured inward gaze of Ryan's lyrics, combined with the brazen yet utterly guileless exuberance of Steve wanting to certify himself as a real-life rock singer by happily belting out those lyrics whenever the band played live. Of everything Ryan wrote for Swizzlefish, my favorite was a song called Within. It wasn't heavy, but it definitely felt grunge, and I always thought it wouldn't have felt out of place as an Eddie Vedder Pearl Jam song. This lyrical declaration of loneliness was so personal to Ryan that it's the only song he wouldn't let Steve sing, not at live shows and not on the recordings we made later, including the one you're listening to right now. At the time, I don't think Steve or I appreciated just how plaintive and sincere Ryan was when he sang this song. To our young minds, Ryan couldn't have been that lonely. He was, after all, collaborating with us to create a super cool grunge band. And from our cheerfully naive perspective, this might have been enough to cancel out at least some of Ryan's loneliness. About halfway through the song, the heavy part kicks in, and Ryan sings, quote, "I run and I run and I run and I run inward, straight into myself, away from you. But you just see me standing. Yeah, the picture I've painted outside, it doesn't move." It feels like this lyric could have been directed at Steve and me as much as anyone. And in retrospect, it feels like we could have been more empathetic to a friend who is clearly struggling with his own demons. Grunge in general was known for the angst of both its lyrics and its public pose. A kind of unhappiness was, for lack of a better phrase, a part of its branding. And while this means one thing at a pop culture consumer level, the truth is that this type of angst and unhappiness might now be categorized under mental illness, a truth underscored by the sad fact that so many high-profile grunge musicians died by suicide. For the record, Ryan eventually worked through his mental health challenges and now works as a wellness coach for people who are experiencing the types of depression, anxiety, and suicidal ideation he once struggled with. When Swizzlefish played a 25-year reunion show back in 2018, Ryan sang the lyrics of Within in deliberate past tense as if to both acknowledge and put to rest the struggles of his younger self. Ryan, in fact, credits his involvement with Swizzlefish as central to his decision to stick around and finish college. And while his lyrics could be melancholy, the band itself was something of a catharsis for the emotional ambivalence that characterized his life at the time. This often came in the form of absurdist humor, and if there's one reason why Ryan allowed me, Rolf Potts, to consider myself an adjacent member of the band, despite my lack of musical talent, it was because I had a knack for making him laugh. In time, Ryan wrote a few songs with the express purpose of having me write weird lyrics and perform them at live shows. This process found its purest form in a song called Surreal, that's S-I-R space R-E-A-L, a song that stood apart from the rest of the Swizzlefish catalog for a number of reasons. First off, it enabled Steve to play his trumpet, which made us one of the rare grunge bands to boast a horn section. Secondly, I didn't sing the lyrics so much as intone them like some kind of demented beat poet. Third, one section of my vocals sounded like this. I'm a rhythm, you are, but you offer no resistance. Need some medication for a fishing of the crystal. Spit up on the soil and it doesn't try to face me. I know the one day that the soil will encase me. I see the dawn and the tonic elevate the sky. When my lips on, lips on, when my body dies. They say that life is what we see and what we hear and feel. But looking through my mind and you will find that I'm surreal. Yeah, I guess that part of the song qualifies as rap rock, and while I can't say we did a particularly masterful job of it, I will say we explored rap rock well before that mashup of musical genres became something of an MTV sensation a few years later. Of course, Surreal was just weird enough that it didn't just qualify as rap rock or experimental spoken word performance, because it also aspired in places to sound like hardcore punk rock. So, while Swizzlefish was created as a grunge band at the very moment grunge was becoming a part of the American zeitgeist, it was also a weird and eclectic and resolutely amateurish flight of fancy that was, and I say this with all the benefit of hindsight all these years later, our own attempt to be more than just consumers of the culture around us. We weren't just observing the zeitgeist, we had joined the zeitgeist. Kind of. So we hoped. Swizzlefish played its first live show in December of 1992 in the basement of the George Fox College Student Union building. Admission was 50 cents. At this point, we still didn't have a bass player, nor did we have amplifiers, which meant that we ran our sound through a set of stereo speakers. To add a note of absurdity to the proceedings, Ryan and I bought a bunch of tube socks, stenciled them with the Swizzlefish band logo, and hurled them into the audience between songs. In addition to the songs Ryan wrote, we covered songs like Nirvana's Love Buzz, Steppenwolf's Born to be Wild, and Should I Stay or Should I Go by The Clash. This is actual audio from that performance. Yes. At this point, I should probably remind you that Swizzlefish was formed at a Christian college campus that didn't allow drinking, social dancing, or R-rated movies in the dorms. The national media was already celebrating grunge as the rebellious sound of Generation X youth, but this tended to overlook the fact that rock had been a dominant cultural expression in America for more than 30 years. Grunge musicians tended to be influenced by songs that their own parents listened to, bands like Black Sabbath and the Stooges, so the old truism that rock was rebel music that shocked the tastes of an older generation hadn't been true in about 20 years, at least not on the broad cultural level. At George Fox College, however, rock was still seen as edgy and impious, and for some students and administrators, potentially evil. Our first Swizzlefish show caused an immediate controversy, less for the secular nature of our songs than for the fact that we made a point of trolling the presumed pieties of our own campus. In what may have been the most punk rock moment of our entire tenure as a band, we played a sex education tape during the intermission of that first show. This wasn't some graphic sexual how-to. It was a film strip entitled, quote, "The Problem of Erotic Activity Before Marriage," end quote, which Ryan had borrowed from the audiovisual holdings of our own campus library. Here's the actual audio from that night.
Now, I say quite bluntly, because we all know it, that sexual intercourse is a beautiful, simple, real, satisfying experience.
Yeah!
You may know it, I hope only from books. I know it from experience. And I would say, and some other married people here,
Kate,
I would say any idea of a duty. When my wife does her duty and lets me have intercourse, why do my duty...
As you can hear, the students in the audience that night rightly found this outdated Christian sex education tape to be hilarious, but other more religious students, many of whom hadn't gone to the concert and were thus inclined to know of it by rumor or gossip, were scandalized by the open irreverence of Swizzlefish, the secular themes of our songs, and our symbolic embrace of what felt like counterculture rebellion. Our first concert was in no way a virtuoso performance, at least not at a musical level, but it electrified the campus in ways that both raised our profile and eventually led to us getting banned from performing on campus. I'll go into the details of how and why our own university administrators eventually forbade Swizzlefish from playing shows at George Fox College, but for now I'll simply admit that the first Swizzlefish concert marked the high point of my own punk rock creativity and the apex of my role as a performer in the band. The photo I've used for this week's episode art is a screen capture from the VHS video we shot of Swizzlefish that night, and while my shoulder-length hair and Sub Pop Records t-shirt make me look like I belonged behind the microphone, I spent the rest of my tenure with the band largely behind the scenes. After the concert, Ryan bought a proper electric guitar and recruited a musically gifted junior named Peter to play the bass. The now four-man band moved its practice room out of the dorms and into the campus music department building, and I rarely, if ever, attended practices there. I did double down on going into Portland to see live music with Ryan and Steve, however. Sometimes we would make the 90-minute round-trip drive two or three times a week to watch punk and grunge and art rock performances. In addition to our favorite all-ages club, the X-Ray Cafe, we saw shows at La Luna, a great medium-sized venue that featured $1 shows on Monday nights, and a seedy Old Town nightclub called Satyricon, which is probably best remembered as the place where Courtney Love met Kurt Cobain for the first time. What we didn't fully appreciate at the time was that our moment in the 1990s would one day be celebrated as the apex of alternative culture in the city of Portland, Oregon.
Do you remember the 90s?
Yeah.
You know, people were talking about getting piercings and getting tribal tattoos.
Yeah.
And people were singing about saving the planet and forming bands.
Yeah.
There's a place where that idea still exists as a reality, and I've been there.
Where is it?
Portland.
Oregon?
Yeah.
Dream of the 90s is alive, Portland.
That's an outtake from the sketch comedy show Portlandia, which ran on AMC's independent film channel nearly two decades after my own grunge era interactions with the city. Portlandia, which satirized the hipster pretensions of a city where, quote, young people go to retire, was a cult hit in the 2010s, and one assumption of the show was that Portland, Oregon, was forever trying to hang on to a kind of grungy authenticity that harkened back to the 1990s. Here's Portlandia creators Carrie Brownstein and Fred Armisen talking about their early experiences in that city.
Portland used to be really seedy.
I remember we pulled up into Portland, everyone's like, it's kind of a druggy place. And I was like, really? And sure enough, in front of the Satyricon, there was totally like people smoking crack. I guess, when's the first time you went to Portland?
Probably 1994.
For those of you keeping score at home, Carrie Brownstein of Portlandia is perhaps best known for forming the indie band Slater Kinney in Olympia, Washington. As it happened, Carrie's band came out of the same Olympia music scene that gave rise to the seminal riot girl punk band Bikini Kill. Bikini Kill was headed up by Kathleen Hanna and Toby Vail, who briefly dated Kurt Cobain in the early 1990s, and is credited with writing the phrase "Kurt smells like teen spirit" on the wall of Cobain's bedroom, a phrase that later found its way into the title of Nirvana's most famous song. The fact that I was attending live shows in Portland a good 2 years before a Pacific Northwest icon like Carrie Brownstein had ever visited the city's music scene is telling, but not in the way you might think. By a certain grunge-era way of thinking, one could posit that I was a part of Portland's music scene before it went mainstream. That is, back when Portland was still seen as a working-class town that was creating grassroots alternative music, in contrast to Seattle's increasingly commercialized grunge scene. But I'm less interested in Portland's retrospective authenticity than I am with the fact that all of those music scenes contain multitudes in ways that were eventually forgotten by the chroniclers of hipster lore. I mean, sure, one did occasionally have to step over crack vials on the way to see shows at the Satyricon, or mingle with the homeless outside of the X-Ray Cafe on Burnside Avenue. For every street-smart musical visionary in attendance at Portland's punk rock clubs, there were hundreds of fairly unremarkable middle-class people, including my friends and me, who were simply looking to have a good time and be a part of Oregon's grunge-adjacent Pacific Northwest zeitgeist. In fact, at the very moment our grunge wannabe band Swizzlefish was scandalizing the religious conservatives of George Fox College, more and more George Fox students were investing in thrift store flannel and making the trip into Portland to see shows there. Whereas the hipsters who haunted places like the X-Ray Cafe slam-danced their way through its mosh pits with a studied sense of ironic detachment, an increasing number of our Christian college friends were partaking in a musical ritual that most certainly represented the most rebellious thing they'd ever done in their young lives.
To the moon, let me know that I think I'm good. You will save my school.
One of the acts that regularly played at venues like the X-Ray Cafe was this band, Big Daddy Meatstraw, whose members performed in clown makeup and Halloween costumes and seemed to delight in satirizing every overblown rock and roll cliche from the previous three decades. Big Daddy Meatstraw never made it big or even recorded an album. This song is from their 1992 demo tape, but they were wildly popular with the X-Ray Cafe's all-ages audience. One big crowd favorite was a song called 15, which was a fairly obvious parody of the pseudo-satanic pretensions of heavy metal music. Though when our copy of the Big Daddy Meatstraw demo tape made the rounds at George Fox College, many students took its overblown lyrics at face value.
Satan's got the power, got the power, got the power.
In fact, as the ragged ethos of Portland's grunge-era indie rock flowed the 45 minutes by car back up Oregon Highway 99 into the boom boxes and tape decks of George Fox College, many of the more conservative members of our student body saw this harsh and noisy music as a threat to the Christian integrity of the campus. To fully appreciate this, one must understand that a given moment in history has many forms of alternative pop culture, including those that purport to embrace conservative religious ideals. In the early 1990s, one of the most popular books in the evangelical Christian independent publishing world was Frank Peretti's This Present Darkness, which endeavored to shed light on the notion of, quote, spiritual warfare, which apparently had something to do with angels and demons fighting in the heavens whenever humans struggled with sinful temptations.
We are not contending against flesh and blood, but we are contending against the principalities, against the powers, and against the rulers of this present darkness.
Peretti's principle of spiritual warfare was something of an evangelical Christian fad in the early 1990s, especially among the more credulous and hysterical true believers, people who insisted on the truth of conspiracy theories like satanic ritual abuse, people who thought that supermarket checkout barcodes were in fact, quote, the mark of the beast foreshadowing the final battle between Jesus and Satan at the end of time. Now, it's worth noting here that these supposedly Christian notions aren't found in the teachings of Jesus. They come from a fairly imaginative and gullible reading of the Book of Revelation, which certain evangelicals have always found more exciting in a certain science fiction way than the humble spiritual humanism that Jesus taught in his gospel sermons. Hence, at a moment when students at progressive Oregon schools like Reed College were looking for, say, structural racism or signifiers of the patriarchy in canonical literary texts, a good number of the students at my Oregon college were debating whether or not angels and demons were literally fist-fighting for souls in the skies above the science building every time biology professors mentioned Darwin's theory of evolution. So it was that at the exact same moment that scores of George Fox College students were driving into Portland to see bands like Big Daddy Meatstraw and Drunk at Abby's, an equal number of students from the same campus were praying to Jesus to, quote, bind Satan from events like volleyball games and trombone recitals. These two opposing forces clashed at the second Swizzlefish concert, which took place after hours in our student union dining hall in February of 1993. On the surface, our second live concert proved to be a success, since Swizzlefish finally had a bassist, proper amps, an electric guitar, and a musical tightness that reflected a further 2 months of practice. The problem was that our music had become all too effective and visceral, particularly when we played this tune.
Yeah!
This song is called A Great Place to Grow, which was the civic motto of Newburg, Oregon, a town of about 15,000 people where George Fox College was located. Ryan's lyrics lambasted the perky optimism of the slogan, and his jeremiad about the limitations of small-town life was underscored by the dark and aggressive distortion of his guitar riffs. Whereas the music hipsters of Portland might have written off this song as a fairly generic angst anthem with a sludgy groove that was obviously trying to sound like Alice in Chains, a small group of evangelical students who had been holding a prayer meeting at the back of the cafeteria that night swore they felt the presence of Satan when the band played it. Add to this the fact that a much larger cohort of George Fox students had started a gleeful mosh pit in front of the stage, and it was hard for the George Fox College Dean of Students to do anything but ban us from ever performing on campus again. The official pretext for not letting us play any more shows on campus had something to do with the fact that moshing qualified as dancing, and by the letter of the law, all forms of social dancing were forbidden at George Fox College. From a pure rock and roll rebel perspective, getting banned from performing at your own school might sound like a counterintuitive triumph of sorts, but in practice I suspect the dean wasn't worried about the evil influence of Swizzlefish so much as he simply got tired of hearing the more pious students complain about us. Indeed, while my old undergrad alma mater may have had old-fashioned sounding moral restrictions, in practice the campus administrators were never all that legalistic about things, and those same rules that forbade drinking and dancing also urged us to practice compassion, kindness, humility, patience, and forgiveness, and that counted for a lot. As an institution, George Fox College and the professors who taught there tended to be a lot more nuanced and open-minded than some of the students, especially the Christian Academy and homeschooled students who often had a paranoid and feverishly overblown sense for what secular culture stood for. In the end, our school's decision to ban us from playing any more shows on campus probably had more to do with insurance liabilities and residential noise concerns than it did with the presumed presence of Satan at Swizzlefish shows. In a way, getting banned from performing on campus allowed Ryan and Steve and their new bandmates to focus on going into the campus recording studio and laying down the 10 tracks that went into what we called Big Time Loser, a kind of glorified demo tape that passes for our first and only album. The phrase Big Time Loser came from the chorus to one of Ryan's new songs, a catchy novelty tune called Lego My Ego, which satirized our own ambitions as a grunge band in a way that still holds up after all these years. I've added the song Lego My Ego as an Easter egg at the very end of this episode. And in fact, if you'd like to hear any of the songs Swizzlefish recorded that year, the Big Time Loser album is available for streaming at Spotify. I've included a link for that playlist in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. A curious footnote to our Big Time Loser album was that it was recorded in an on-campus studio that was accustomed to recording and mixing Christian praise music. Our music was, of course, far more abrasive and secular than praise music, but the default sound levels for the songs on our album broke one of the unspoken rules of grunge, which Weird Al Yankovic paid tribute to in his 1992 grunge parody song Smells Like Nirvana. Indeed, while Weird Al was lampooning Nirvana songs that were mumbled out from behind a wall of noise and distortion, the Swizzlefish vocals were as prominent in the mix and drenched with reverb as any Christian praise song extolling the love of Jesus or the power of the Holy Spirit. When you also factor in the fact that the guitar and bass were accidentally recorded a half step above normal tuning and that Steve played his trumpet on some of the songs, the Big Time Loser album winds up sounding like one of the more curious and unique and weirdly true to itself grunge relics to come out of the Pacific Northwest in 1993. Though I wasn't all that involved with the recording of the Big Time Loser demo, I did throw myself into directing a music video for the song Somebody's Liver. I fancied myself something of a film auteur back in the day, and over the course of that winter and spring, I spent my spare time filming various members of the band using an SVHS video camera I'd borrowed from the school's audiovisual department. I shot Ryan jumping up and down on a trampoline at night, pretending to play his guitar in the strobe of a spotlight. I shot Steve in his dorm room wearing a paper mask that made him look like our middle-aged college president. And I shot our drummer Matt and our bassist Peter playing inside of a darkened TV studio in the beam of a slide projector that lit them up in abstract patterns of light. Now, if you think this all sounds a bit pretentious and absurd and very much in keeping with what a 22-year-old with artistic aspirations might think was cool to put into a grunge-era music video, well, then you'd probably be onto something. The video is available on YouTube if you're curious, and I've embedded it in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. Now, at this point, I should probably step back a bit and acknowledge how subjective my recollections of the early 1990s have been. Grunge may have been a musical buzzword in the spring of 1993, and later that year, Time magazine would anoint the movement by putting Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam on its cover. But the number one album in America that spring was pop singer Whitney Houston's soundtrack to a Kevin Costner movie called The Bodyguard. And while Portland's music scene would later be remembered for its gritty authenticity, few of the acts we saw at places like the X-Ray Cafe are remembered now. A band called Everclear went on to make a few radio hits in the mid-1990s, and Elliott Smith's ascendance as an indie rock icon made it retroactively cool to have seen him perform as the frontman of Heatmiser. But for the most part, the bands we dreamed of opening for, bands like Pond and Drunken Abbeys and Hazel, never made much of an impact outside of the Pacific Northwest. The most significant moment in the entire Swizzlefish tenure as a Pacific Northwest grunge band came on a rainy Thursday night in April of 1993 when we opened for a band called Dimbulb at the X-Ray Cafe. This is the Dimbulb song Holiday of Sparks, which was put out by Galaxy Records a few years later. Dimbulb is another one of those Portland bands that never became all that well known outside of the local music scene. But since they did later open for Heatmiser, who had opened for Sprinkler, who had opened for Nirvana, opening for Dimbulb became our conduit to grunge immortality, if in a highly credulous and abstract 4 degrees of separation kind of way. The task of booking Swizzlefish a gig at the X-Ray Cafe that spring had been as simple as me calling up the club's owner and asking him if we could play a set there. He was welcoming, if a bit sardonic at the sight of us, and getting paired with Dimbulb on the bill that night was a matter of random chance. Swizzlefish made $40 from the gate receipts that night, which means after having split that amount with the four members of the band, I made a career total of $8 as a grunge band manager in the 1990s. We didn't have the equipment to record audio of the Swizzlefish set that night, so I can't replay any of those songs here. But to be honest, the night was less remarkable for how it sounded than for how it looked. At least 50 George Fox College students had packed into the X-Ray Cafe to see us that night, and despite the fact that most of them showed up wearing flannel shirts and torn jeans, the club's management marveled at how wholesome and polite they were. As it happened, the rise of the grunge scene had never really put my little Christian college in danger of spiritual regression, despite fears that some people had in that community. Ironically, the enthusiasm that George Fox students developed for grunge that year very much did taint the avant-garde counterculture ethos of places like the X-Ray Cafe. This is, in fact, what I had in mind when I wanted to entitle my never-completed grunge memoir, quote, How I Ruined the 1990s. When I say ruined, I don't mean that I set out to wreak havoc on the grunge zeitgeist. No, my way of ruining the 1990s was much subtler and more universal than that. In joining the cultural bandwagon, just as a zeitgeist moment was happening in the Pacific Northwest, my presence certified the inevitable mainstreaming and ultimate decline of what the zeitgeist originally stood for. Much earlier in this episode, I mentioned that I briefly appeared in Doug Prey's 1996 grunge documentary Hype. Specifically, I show up in a crowd shot 2 minutes and 3 seconds into a song called Rock Collection, which you're listening to now, as performed by a Portland sub-pop band called Pond. There must have been upwards of 20 George Fox kids in the audience that night, and I clearly recall the film crew struggling to get shots of people who looked authentically counterculture among all the fresh-faced Christian college kids. The only reason I appear in the crowd shot, I'd reckon, is I was standing behind some Portland hipster who was wearing a face-obscuring slasher movie-style ski mask. My friend Steve shows up wearing his black Swizzlefish t-shirt, but only because he was standing near a young woman who was wearing a Die Yuppie Scum t-shirt. If this outtake was never included in the final version of the documentary, it might have a lot to do with the fact that all the George Fox students in the crowd that night made the scene look insufficiently hip and cutting edge. The thing is, America's alternative culture rarely threatens Middle America, since Middle America has a way of soaking up all manifestations of counterculture and making them its own. By 1993, Americans anywhere could already turn on their TV sets and see this ad for a certain consumer electronics retailer.
The music of Seattle is as progressive as the people. Listen to Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Nirvana. Where else can you get the Seattle sound? Best Buy.
Even more notorious in retrospect was this 1993 TV commercial that tried to use punk rock as a metaphor for why you should buy a certain kind of car.
Do you remember when rock and roll was really boring and corporate? Well, punk challenged all this and said, hey, excuse me, but here's what's cool about music, remember? Now, Subaru, with this Impreza, is challenging some car thinking here. This car is all about reminding you and me what's great about a car and moving forward and making cars better and less disappointing. Just like punk, except it's cars.
Counterculture expressions getting co-opted by uncool normal people was nothing new. Look at any photo from a moment of supposed zeitgeist in American history, and it will be clear that not everyone in that moment represented the cutting edge of culture. For example, if you study footage taken at the Woodstock Music Festival back in the summer of 1969, you'll find that right there alongside the zeitgeist kids who were clad in bell-bottoms and tunics and peasant skirts were thousands of other young people wearing horn-rimmed glasses and button-up collared shirts and sensible shoes. As it happens, the most telling MTV clip associated with the band from our 1990s Portland music scene was the video for Everclear's Heroin Girl, which you're listening to right now. As the title suggests, the song is about the narrator's troubled relationship with the girl who eventually dies of a drug overdose. But in the video, the people dancing around as the band plays the song under a bridge in Portland are a bunch of gleefully goofy high school and college kids who'd answered an ad in the local alternative newspaper announcing that the band needed extras for an MTV shoot. These kids don't look like they had or ever would try heroin. They rightfully look like a bunch of dorks who were thrilled to be skipping out on chemistry class or study hall or tennis practice. These kinds of people, people who looked a lot like my own friends did in the same music scene around the same time, make bad visual shorthand when photographers and filmmakers try to tell the story of a certain moment in music history. Yet these refreshingly uncool-looking people belong to those moments as much as the people who look trendier and more cutting-edge. It could actually be argued that it's more enjoyable to be an exuberant poser than it is to be an authenticity-obsessed music scene hipster. And moreover, I'd wager that without all those goofy-looking normal people joining a given hipster scene, there would be no real story to tell the rest of the world years later, since that story would remain subcultural and regional and thus exist outside of the wider scope that retrospectively defines moments of zeitgeist. If I seem to be belaboring this point, it probably has a lot to do with the fact that no 20th century music trend was quite so pointedly scornful of, quote, normal people as grunge was. In 1993, when most all of the events I'm describing happened, Nirvana singer Kurt Cobain was quoted as saying that there were too many, quote, average people coming to our shows and I don't want them there. Kurt Cobain was, of course, a complicated guy, and there's an extent to which statements like this were compensating for the fact that he himself hailed from an uncool hick town, and that he was trying to refashion himself by the rarefied hipster standards of urban Seattle or Olympia, Washington. In fact, 28 years after Kurt complained about average people coming to his shows, the same journalist who'd conducted that interview with him, Michael Azarad, pointed out in a New Yorker article that Kurt, quote, understood that every good legend has a protagonist and also an antagonist. Part of the mythology of grunge, in other words, was the exaggerated sense that it was rebelling against the mainstream, even as it very much became a part of the mainstream. Kurt would have no doubt professed to hate Swizzlefish and hate me and hate all of the Christian college nerds who traveled into Portland to see live music there, but only in the same sense that the more committed music hipsters of Portland, people whose taste he no doubt would have approved of, had already come to hate Nirvana based entirely on their popularity with jocks and Christian college nerds and other, quote, normal people. 1 month after Swizzlefish played the X-Ray Cafe, I graduated from George Fox College and moved to suburban Seattle, where I found work as a landscape maintenance worker. I've talked about this job many times over the years, since at the time I was saving up money for what became my first long-term journey, an 8-month van trip around North America that I mentioned in the pages of my first book, Vagabonding. What I talk about less often from that time in my life is that I actually saw Nirvana perform at an 800-seat theater in downtown Seattle that August as part of a benefit show honoring the recently murdered Seattle punk singer Mia Zapata. Right now, you're listening to the audio from a video of that old 1993 concert that I found on YouTube. This is their song Scentless Apprentice, which was the second track on Nirvana's In Utero album when it was released 1 month later. Indeed, you can count me among the Nirvana fans who heard the song played live before it was publicly available in record stores. You can also see a glimpse of me standing in line for that Seattle Nirvana show about 41 seconds into the YouTube clip in question. Look at the other people standing in line near me, and it's clear that most of the people who went out of their way to see Nirvana that night would also qualify as average or normal or not particularly cool, at least not according to the public standards of authenticity that grunge musicians aspired to back then. But one could argue that normal people who try and mimic the culture around them can create their own kind of authenticity. Swizzlefish never came close to making it big in the 1990s, but it did create an indie rock legacy of sorts, and to give you a sense for that, I'll introduce you to this guy.
I'm Matt Friesen. I'm 44 years old and live in Coos Bay, Oregon. I discovered Swizzlefish around the age of 15 when a youth group leader brought a tape to share with me and a few friends, and it was one of the earliest recollections I had of indie music in the sense of kind of do it yourself, independent of the music establishment. Not long after hearing Swizzlefish for the first time, me and a few of those friends actually started our own band. The cool thing about Swizzlefish was just, it was one of those bands that it got canonized right away as something that ended up in my most important experiences when I was first getting into music.
Matt Friesen's band never came close to making it big either, but they did attract a small following and play a few live shows in Portland in the mid-1990s. The fact that Matt's musical journey can be traced back to a cassette copy of a Swizzlefish tape that a George Fox student shared with him says a lot about how people discovered music back in the 1990s. We only made a couple hundred copies of our album Big Time Loser back in 1993, and until recently I never thought much about where those tapes might have ended up. Had I not uploaded my music video for Somebody's Liver to YouTube back in 2016, I might never have known what kind of ripple effect the music of Swizzlefish has had over the years. Here's Matt again.
And then I was on YouTube, and because me and my friends still talk about Swizzlefish once in a while, it'll come up. And my friend sent me the link to it on YouTube. He's like, dude, it's on YouTube. And then I look at whose YouTube channel it was on. I'm like, Rolf Potts. Like, how many Rolf Pottses can there be? You know, it didn't make any sense because I knew you as a travel writer. And then like this random band from when I was 16 years old in the Pacific Northwest. And I just had to send you a note. I'm like, dude, how are you connected to Swizzlefish?
Indeed, uploading my old Swizzlefish music video to YouTube has made me something of a gatekeeper to the band's modest legacy. Every once in a while, I'll get an email from someone who wants to know what became of the band or where one might stream some of their old songs. For the handful of people who saw us live or listened to our tape back in the day, the music of Swizzlefish has become a form of nostalgia that reminds them of a certain time in their own lives. If Swizzlefish helps explain the 1990s, and honestly I think it does, it could be in the way that jumping on the bandwagon and trying to be part of a cultural moment puts you into a conversation with that moment in a way that feels significant. In retrospect, our inherent uncoolness feels kind of cool. Our inauthenticity seems weirdly authentic, and more than three decades later, I retain both vivid memories and a stubborn sense of pride for having been a part of it. This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. Right now you're listening to a song called Lego My Ego from the 1993 Swizzlefish album Big Time Loser. To hear more Swizzlefish songs on Spotify or watch the music video for the song Somebody's Liver on YouTube or learn about any of the music that was mentioned in this episode, check out my links in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts. I'm a monkey, I'm a chick, think I'm fine, simply divine. Then again, my daddy thinks I'm some kind of hippie. Yeah, but all the people love me. I am who they want to be. Yes, my life is grand now that I am in a band. The big time. Big time, I'm a big time loser. Now I'm in a skirt, hey, I'm an extrovert, and I've got an ego. That's the size I'm meant to say I be.
I'm a monkey shine, but chicks think I'm fine, simply divine. Then again, my daddy thinks I'm some kind of carefree. Yeah, but all the people love me. I am who they want to be. Yes, my life is grand now that I am in a band. The big time, the big time. I'm a big time, a big time loser. If it's a good day, or if it's a bad day, I'm always happy. Because I'm not you. Flannel shirt, now and then a skirt. Hey, I'm an extrovert, and I've got an ego. That's the size I'm necessary. I'm a monkey shine, but chicks think I'm fine, simply divine. Then again, my daddy thinks I'm some kind of hippie. Yeah, but all the people love me. I am who they want to be. Yes, my life is grand. Now that I am in a band. It's a big time. It's a big time. I'm a big time loser. And if it's a good day, or if it's a bad day, I'm always happy. Because I'm not you.
So, Rob, I'm going to start with a few confessions, and I'll just fire them away, and you can make of them what you want. One is that I discovered 60 songs that explain the 90s late, and so I listened to the episodes at double speed.
You listen to me at 2x. That's what you're saying to me?
Well, what I'm saying is that I got so used to it that you sort of had this witty, rapid-fire cadence that I got used to. And so when I was preparing this podcast and, you know, I read your book and I was going back to the episodes, you sound sort of depressed and stoned by comparison.
I sound like I'm not high on cocaine is what you're saying. That's I'm frightened by the idea of me at double speed. I salute you for dealing with me at that speed. That's very terrifying.
I fear that oftentimes the questions I ask you will be a pretext for me to talk about myself as a fellow.
That's what I want you to do. That's the whole point. That is literally the whole point. So just tell me everything about yourself, please.
I'm 8 years older than you, and I went to college in the Pacific Northwest. And so I think I'm exactly the kind of guy that you, Rob Harvilla, would have looked at and thought, that guy's kind of cool. And you would have been wrong because I was not, but I was living in the Pacific Northwest in the 1990s. I was an extra in the movie Dr. Giggles. I had a sub-pop loser shirt.
Excuse me. Okay. List your stuff and then we're going back to Dr. Giggles. Okay.
Well, actually, Rob, let's talk about Dr. Giggles and then I want to quote your book. So I'll let you interview me about Dr. Giggles briefly and then I want to take a quote from your book. So I'm here. I'm at your service.
All right. Thank you. I am not a horror movie person at all. I can't do it at all anymore. And I could barely do it even as a kid or as a teenager. Like I grew up, I was a kid in the 80s, right? And like I would go to video stores and I would look at the backs of the boxes of like A Nightmare on Elm Street and like freak myself out. I saw Dr. Giggles in the theater. I remember this vividly. It was a rare occasion where I went to a horror movie by choice. And so I don't mean to offend you. I don't know if that's the greatest movie I've ever seen in my life. You know, I don't know if it rises to the level of like Wayne's World, for example, but I do cherish that memory. What scene are you in? I don't know if I'm going to rewatch Dr. Giggles, but if I ever do, like, where do I find you?
There's a party scene where the cops go in and they break up like some sort of teenage party where everybody's hanging out by their cars. And then... Mm-hmm. Actually, Rob, it's been so long since I've seen it. And I was basically looking for myself. And so I'm the guy driving the purple Volkswagen, which I did not own, but somehow knew how to drive.
Okay. So you did stunt work on Dr. Giggles, I think, objectively. If you drove a car or were even sitting in a car, I think that counts. I think you are canonically a stuntman in a horror movie. And that is awesome. I think you're cool right now.
I think so. I think I should change my bio, actually. I think I should front load.
Totally. You got to lead with Dr. Giggles. Yes.
Seriously. And in particular, the stunt aspect. Well, that movie was filmed in Portland, Oregon, which is near where I was going to school at the time. And I'm going to quote your book about the 90s. You say, I wore ratty flannel shirts. I wore ratty t-shirts underneath flannel shirts. I watched the videos for Smells Like Teen Spirit and Jeremy and Down in a Hole 10 million times a piece. I bought the CDs these songs came from and listened to them a full 20 million times a piece. I rented the Seattle deifying 1992 Cameron Crowe rom-com singles from Blockbuster, and I deified Seattle in turn. It was the coolest, loudest, greatest city on earth. So tell me about your imaginative relationship with Seattle as young Ohio Rob Harvilla.
Yes. You know, I had the Pearl Jam, the Stickman t-shirt, you know, with the arms spread, you know, I loved this music so much. Pearl Jam's 10 was the third CD I ever owned. The Spin Doctors was my first, of course. I bought completely into the myth that, you know, Seattle was Valhalla, you know, and years later, I worked for a company that had an office in Seattle, and I went there, and I just sat in an office building and ate Jimmy John's, and it was just not a satisfying Seattle experience based on my experience of it for movies, music, etc. But no, I was living in Medina, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland. And, you know, for years after that, every city was going to be the next Seattle, right? So I'm in Columbus now. And in the mid to late 90s, there was a moment when Columbus convinced itself it was about to be the next Seattle. And that didn't about work out, but it really is impossible to convey how cool Seattle seemed, you know, just listening to Dirt, you know, just watching Singles. You know, the fashion was mystifying to me. The shorts with tights underneath it, you know, the Chris Cornell look, like I couldn't figure out like what exactly was going on there. But of course, you know, the weirder it was, the cooler it was to me. Oh no, I thought Seattle was the coolest city on earth.
You know, in retrospect, the city where I lived near Portland, I didn't even live in Portland, but, I spent most of my time in going to Portland shows but wishing I was in Seattle, not realizing that Portland was pretty cool. I think Ohio retrospectively is sort of a retrospectively as cool as Seattle kind of place. So I'm curious, did you go to any shows or attend any events where you didn't realize how cool it was and you were around people who would eventually be famous? Because I saw like 12 Heatmiser shows, and at all of them, I was sort of wishing I was in Seattle, not realizing that Elliott Smith was like 2 feet away from me. I didn't realize that Elliott Smith was Elliott Smith when he was in Heatmiser. So I'm curious if you have like a parallel Ohio experience where you were like some equivalent of Kim Deal was hanging out by you and you didn't appreciate it at the time.
I could not have ever actually physically stood next to Kim Deal. I would just melt into a puddle, probably. I don't know about hanging out with famous people. I've been talking to people a lot this past week about the Green Day show at Blossom Amphitheater, you know, in the Cleveland, in the greater Cleveland area, where there was a grass fight on the lawn and Dookie had just came out and it was $5 and everyone bought a t-shirt. Like, I think that was the Woodstock, the original Woodstock of Ohio. I don't know if I have a Heat Miser, an Elliott Smith caliber experience like that, but I do, in retrospect, appreciate, you know, the very specific earthy radness of Ohio. It's not quite Seattle, or it's not quite the Seattle of my mind when I was a teenager, but it was cooler than I thought. That's fair to say.
Well, I think one of the reasons I bring this up is sometimes we sort of narrate ourselves into eras like the 90s retrospectively in sort of self-congratulatory ways. I've been to the Gilman, yeah, the famous punk club in Berkeley, one time, and and I felt very awkward the whole time. I didn't feel at home. I just felt like an interloper. Yeah. But this was in January of 94. This is 2 weeks before Green Day dropped Dookie. And so now that's my story. Oh my now that God. That's my Gilman story, is that 2 weeks before Green Day released Dookie, I was the most awkward guy at a Rancid Avail show at the Gilman. So
you were at a Rancid Avail show at Gilman in 1994. That's, I can understand feeling awkward, but in retrospect, that's pretty cool, dude. I think you have retroactively become cool. Even, and in the fact that you were awkward at the time somehow makes it cooler in my estimations, you know. So once again, good job. This is quite a resume you have. I'm intimidated, honestly.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Rob Harvilla has deemed me cool. So Rob, here are the questions. I wrote down a few questions for you. The first one is a softball. Did grunge really kill hair metal?
I've returned to this question again and again and again. It truly fascinates me. And I think what I'm circling, I think what I'm honing in on is the idea that I clung to MTV. You know, I grew up on MTV in the 80s, and that's how it felt on MTV. You know, I wake up one morning, I'm watching Winger, Cinderella, Poison, Motley Crue, the Bullet Boys, right? And then I wake up the following morning and I'm watching Nirvana, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It felt overnight. And it felt like a death. It felt like a murder. It felt like Kurt Cobain, you know, personally wiped Warrant from the face of the earth. And I think that's largely MTV that made me think that. And it is important because I was counting on MTV to tell me what to like, what to listen to, what to buy. I was enthralled to them at the time.
Had you hung out with Kurt Cobain in 1992, would he have liked you?
Do I? The answer to that is I am 13. And so probably not. I don't really know the commonality. What would we talk about? You know, we would talk about Weird Al Yankovic, right? I think that the common point of spiritual interest for me at 13 and Kurt Cobain at the height of his powers is like how cool Weird Al Yankovic is and like how funny Smells Like Nirvana was, you know, like otherwise, no, I don't think I was a very good hang when I was 13, even amongst 13-year-olds living where I was living. You know, I can't imagine that Kurt would have found me too scintillating, you know, at that time or frankly at any time. No offense to me, but that's probably just the facts.
Well, I wonder in retrospect, who actually felt cool in the 1990s? Because I think there's an aspect... There's sort of a protective aspect to Kurt Cobain. Like I read enough Kurt Cobain interviews of him talking about how he hated regular people coming to his concerts. And I felt like one of those regular people. So I felt like I was literally ruining his day I saw him live once in 1993. But the weird thing is that it felt like he was this Aberdeen guy who was sort of trying to strike an Olympia Washington pose. What do you think about this? Because I always felt like Kurt Cobain would have hated my guts. When in fact he was just this small town guy who I think was trying to be cool by the standards of Olympia and Seattle and Portland.
You're absolutely onto something here. Okay, so first of all, when I'm 13, you know, and living in Ohio. Kurt Cobain is from Seattle, you know, which is objectively incorrect, but like Kurt Cobain is the essence of Seattle for me. And it's not until I grow up and like read a fucking book, right, where I learned that, you know, he was from Aberdeen, which was this small town, you know, and like, I forget what he tried to say his first show was, I think Black Flag. Like he always told reporters that his first show was, I think, Black Flag, when in reality it was Sammy Hagar. But no, he's from Aberdeen. And first he goes to Olympia, you know, which is like a college town where all the cool kids hang out, you know, and Calvin Johnson is doing like cakewalks or whatever. And then he goes to Seattle and you hear all these stories about how he didn't feel cool at all. And he was intimidated and he felt like nobody respected him and he didn't feel, you know, like he belonged there. And I don't think he ever did. And that feeling of not belonging in the place that you're ostensibly dominating, you know, I think is the through line of a lot of the Nirvana story. But, you know, all of that context, all of that reality gets collapsed, you know, by the myth of just Kurt Cobain just rose up out of the muck of Seattle, you know, as this Jesus figure, you know, and everybody loved him and he loved everybody, except he hated everybody because that's cooler. You know, it's the music is cooler to you when you're a teenager, when you flatten all that nuance, you know, into this bullshit story, you know, that still rings true for you. And it still rings true for me now, even if I know it's bullshit.